Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Which I'm going to steal from John Farrell right now, folks. You do that when you're speaking to the laureate Michael Spence of New York University. And that when you're a gentleman who changed graduate school education across this nation profoundly, as Michael Spence did at Stanford GSB a few years ago, and when you do what he did within economics across numerous economics platforms, including our study of information, how we receive, how we push, how we miss information, with his Nobel Prize with Mr. Akerlof and Mr. Stiglitz, there's a lot of ways to go. And of course, Farrow's brilliant and goes right to the moment, which is in crisis, what do we do? Turkey's in crisis. The central bank comes out, what, John, 40 minutes ago?
Says we will take the necessary steps, whatever that means. And then the reports come out of Turkey that he'll be meeting with the president, Mr. Erdogan.
Do models work? Everybody's got all this advice and help in that. And yet, after Guy Johnson's interview with Mr. Erdogan yesterday, nobody uses the models in crisis, do they?
No, because they don't work in crisis. I mean, what you have instead of models is experience, a growing body of experience. And so if your currency comes under attack, you basically have to let it decline a bit and then raise interest rates and do a balancing act. But the the models themselves just don't capture this.
How difficult is it to regain credibility with markets when markets no longer believe you have any? Argentina, a great example of that over the last couple of weeks.
Right.
How difficult is it to respond to that?
Well, if you respond, I mean, you can do it. But it's not easy, and if you make several mistakes in a row, then it's then it gets a lot harder. So, I mean, I think, and you know, and then it takes a long time. The Russian case was a good example. I mean, the Russia Central Bank took quite a while, but eventually reestablished its credibility, and the currency stabilized several years ago. Remember this episode? So,
yeah.
It's better. It's certainly better not to make, you know, well-known mistakes in dealing with this.
You mentioned the asymmetry
for
central banks looking at their currencies. Walk us through what central banks may or may not have learned economic history.
Well, what I was saying is that, you know, I mean, in the Asian financial crisis, I mean, some of these countries tried to hold up their currencies because they had dollar or hard currency denominated debt. And they basically ran out of reserves doing that, at which point, you know, chaos ensues. That's the one side. That's propping up your currency.
Yeah.
And you run out of ammunition. You know, you have the British case and a whole lot of experience.
Yeah.
On the other side, you can, it's not necessarily a good idea if you overdo it, but you can hold down the currency by accumulating reserves for a fairly long period of time. And and so that's the asymmetry. There's much less severe limits in the, on that side of the ledger.
What you wrought at Stanford was ultimately about executive leadership and government. We have not been able to speak to you since President Xi decided he would take a more lengthy term with a new communist experiment in China. Your comments, please, on the distinction of one or two terms or forever terms, and particularly within the new template of a new, more totalitarian regime in China.
Right. So China has moved in the direction of being much, having the party both clean up its act and be much more intrusive in multiple parts of the society and the economy. I think Chinese are, you know, when you get them to speak frankly, you know, sort of off the record, understand that the reform program is sufficiently large that they're willing to grant that maybe two terms wasn't ideal at this stage, you know, because you become a lame duck in the second term. And therefore, they might have thought that, you know, extending that is not a bad idea. That's a little different than, you know, than leader for life. And so I do think in within China, there are people who are nervous about that, that rather extreme version of altering the term limits that they abided by for several transitions.
Very quickly here, on the linkage, the correlations of the markets, I feel like I'm talking to Professor Engel over at NYU.
Right.
Do you see correlations that can cause challenges?
I mean, I'm not an expert at this, but my sense is that correlations go up when there's turmoil or crisis.
Yes, yes.
For sure. And that certainly does cause problems. I mean, it causes problems for investors because it, you know, reduces the benefits of diversification.
Right.
But it's also a signal that there's trouble somewhere.
Mike, we have to leave there. Michael Spence, thank you so much. Greatly appreciated. He is at New York University, among other things. Can't say enough about his book. I'll throw it out on my book Twitter site here from 5, 6, 7 years ago as well.
Through 2017, foreign exchange was boring. I can tell you in 2018, FX is anything but boring. Joining us now, David Riley, Blue Bay Asset Management Chief Investment Strategist. David, just talk to me about what is happening in foreign exchange and how it's changing your world.
Well, the big story is that we've seen this resurgence in the US dollar, and I think that's a pain trade for the market more generally, I think for risk assets, and we've clearly seen that spill over into emerging markets. And, you know, I think that rather than actually higher US rates has been the catalyst for exposing those emerging markets which have either weak fundamentals and weak policy credibility, and that's really been Argentina and it's been Turkey.
So this raises the question, David. Over the last several weeks, when I've asked many investors and strategists about the renewed, resurgent US dollar strength story, the pushback I get is this is just a squaring of positions. I struggle to find the belief in the move. The short story has been a slow burn to eventually capitulate. David, where are we? Do people believe in this yet, that this could last?
I still don't think people believe it will last. And broadly speaking, I mean, I'd share that view. And I think what's fundamental to that view is during the course of 2017 and coming into this year, it was a global reflation story. The US was not the only economy that was growing strongly and where you could get both higher rates, but also higher equities and risk, growth-sensitive risk assets. Emerging markets were doing well. China was doing well. Europe was really powering ahead and was a big upside surprise. What we have now is that we've had some weak data. We've got Japan printing a negative print on Q1 GDP. Europe has come off the boil. And so I think the dollar move is really reflecting, going back to that story whereby maybe the US is the only place in town, and that has implications both in terms of divergence in rates, but also in terms of where you can get returns. If I think the market, and we do believe here that we will get a rebound in global growth in the second quarter, that slowdown in Europe is largely transitory, China still holding up. And if that occurs, then I think this rally in the dollar kind of runs out of steam.
Well, you bring up rates, though, and rate differentials are clearly a story that we should be talking about. It looks like rates are recoupling with foreign exchange. If you look at rates in the United States relative to rates in, say, Europe, and look at Germany, that two-year Bund Treasury spread has blown out to 314, 315 basis points. That screams dollar strength. It screams euro-dollar must go lower. David, why does that relationship not reestablish itself in a more material way that is lasting?
But I think that spread gap, or that, you know, yield gap on the 2 year, is reflecting that the market's been pricing in higher Fed hiking path, and we saw that on the back of yesterday's US retail sales data. Well, they've actually been taking out some sort of path for normalization starting next year in terms of ECB rates. And that's what's been driving. And what's been driving it has been disappointing growth data coming out of Europe and better than expected data coming out of the US. I think once we start getting convergence in that economic data, we'll start getting a closing in that two-year gap, and then the dollar runs out of steam.
David, what is fascinating to me is how all of us of any ilk have forgotten a 10% correction and an 18% bear market in stocks. And of course, folks, we can go much worse than an 18% bear market. Is our rationalization of these new instabilities different now because we really don't remember the volatility you and I studied and lived for years?
I think it's a good point, Tom, that the market and investors for a very long period now have got used to having central banks and particularly the Fed at your back, and therefore, you know, they crushed volatility. I think Jerome Powell made a remark some time ago about the Fed's balance sheet was essentially taking volatility out of the market. They had a sort of short volatility position. And with the Fed running down its balance sheet, gradually normalizing interest rates, the famous Fed put, I think, is quite a long way out of the money, then I think we're going to get more volatility. And where I think we're getting caught out a little bit on the investor side is that we have not fully built that into the way that we're positioning. So I think part of the volatility that we've seen in U.S. equities with the short ETFs and in places like Argentina, for example, if we bring it to there, has been very crowded positioning. Then you get a volatility shock or catalyst for volatility, and then everyone's scrambling, and it's a one-way market, and everyone's scrambling for an exit that's very narrow.
David, we're talking about shocks, but I just wonder whether this is all sort of a natural, gradual process of rebalancing portfolios away from risk. If you think about what QE was for, it was about rebalancing portfolios towards risk assets. Now, as they wind down QE on a global basis and QE becomes QT, quantitative tightening, shouldn't the opposite apply, that you rebalance away from risk?
To some degree, but it's also, remember that QE was taking duration and was squeezing the term premium. So if you're a euro investor right now, is it an obvious thing to do to go out and buy 10-year bunds at 60 basis points? Is it an obvious thing to do to go out and buy UK gilts, which are giving you a negative real rate of, you know, between 1% and 2%? I think treasuries for a US investor are starting to look potentially pretty attractive. So I think we may well get some of that rotation that you're describing in the US. But I think what's crucial in Europe is that even as the ECB brings QE to an end, is there forward guidance? Do they anchor short-term interest rates? And if they do, volatility will remain constrained. And I think on that basis, things like, you know, sovereign credit as well as corporate credit can actually do okay.
David, what's a cash right now? I mean, as John mentioned earlier, on a real basis, cash has value. And on a percent growth of yield, cash is outrageously wonderful versus what, John, 6 months ago? Is cash like is cash like the new asset?
Well, I think cash and that move higher in cash rates in the United States has been one of the most profound shifts during the first part of this year. And I think some of the repricing we've seen of emerging market credit has been a response to that higher US cash rate and also the higher FX hedging costs that implied. Basically, you needed wider spreads and a repricing in order to justify why you would be holding an emerging market credit dollar asset versus, exactly as you've alluded to, Tom, holding US cash. I think you're absolutely right that US cash has become, you know, a factor. But again, I come back to the rest of the world. When we as investors decide that we're going to part some money into cash on some of our euro-denominated strategies, it's actually costing us 50 basis points to actually do that, let alone the opportunity cost of the loss of carry as well. So
it's a good point,
at the moment, it's more of a US story than a European and rest of the world story.
David Reilly, thank you so much from BlueMay this morning with us.
I'm really pleased to say that a quick phone call away, and Jane Foley joins us, head of FX strategy at Rabobank, and joining us out of the capital, the global capital of foreign exchange, the City of London. Jane, it's always great to catch up with you. There is some euro weakness, some dollar strength. How much of a pain trade is evolving in the FX market at the moment, Jane?
Well, I think actually we can go back to February to see the beginning of this. And I think if we look back then, we do see the dollar really beginning to perform well against emerging markets, which of course are perhaps more sensitive to risk appetite, certainly more sensitive to higher US rates than perhaps some of the other markets. But it was only really a few weeks ago where the breakdown in euro dollar really began to focus the market's attention on the strength of the dollar. But I think really today there's now more attention on Italian politics and...
Yeah.
And perhaps more attention on the structural weaknesses within the euro as well as on dollar strength as well.
Before we get to the European side of the trade, let's begin with the US dollar. Is the consensus short dollar position for 2018, is it capitulating, Jane?
I think it probably is. And we changed the view. It was March the 15th when I took out the view for higher euro dollar and put in a stronger dollar. And this was partly because of that picture that was emerging with lower levels of risk appetite, the fact that emerging markets were beginning to get a little bit more worried. And that, I think, was retreating from these high risk or high yield trades back into the US dollar. So I think at that point also the market had built up, you know, pretty short dollar positions and was also pretty long in a lot of high risk markets, and including long in euro as well.
Within this, Jane, and we heard this yesterday from one guest, which is the rationalization that people bet one way, for whatever reason, we're moving another way, and we'll go in a step basis. To me, that's market chat and trader chat for the idea of rationalizing moves. Is the rationalizing you see on the Rabobank desks, is it the same as other instabilities we've seen, or is there something different this time?
Well, I think perhaps this is not a crisis in the way that we've had crises before. And to be honest, I think with this one, I think a large part of it might be just positioning. I think the market really got excited last year. There was so much risk appetite in 2017. We had far better global growth than most people had anticipated from places like Europe and places like Japan. And that really lifted risk appetite. And people were really pushing ahead of themselves to get hold of a high risk, high yield, etc. And I think that took us into this very first part of this year. But I think as we moved into February, that began to change. And I think the market was just positioned perhaps all wrongly in order to face a new world of less risk appetite.
I mean, just as an example, and folks, a bank like Rabobank deals with this in the trenches. We're all talking dollar-based speculation. Business has to get done, and with a strong Chairman Powell dollar, for whatever reason, whatever anybody's theory, the fact is oil and goods in an EM economy, a non-OPEC EM economy, really begins to pain the public, which folds into the political process. I'm describing Turkey as one example. What's that tension right now, Jane Foley, that Rabobank hedgers see, not speculators? What do the hedgers see in terms of domestic pain in EM?
There's a huge amount of tension, a huge amount of pain, certainly in countries such as Turkey and countries such as Argentina. And I think if we look at Poland also, I think the movement in that currency is not anticipated by the majority this year. So companies that are trying to deal with it are certainly feeling the brunt. And this will have an impact on investment and potentially on growth for a while to come.
And what's so important, Jane, is you see it not, you know, they're not doing in Argentina, but Brazil was pretty ugly yesterday. Or Malaysia's bringing back a 92-year-old, I get it, and there's a pop and a recovery, but there are these set of tensions, folks, that aren't about three zip codes in New York, they're not about three zip codes in London, they're not about two zip codes in Hong Kong or Singapore. Jane, they're about these domestic economies. When do they begin to snap or break?
Well, I think perhaps they are, and I would, you know, Argentina, I think they have broken. Turkey, I think, is coming to a boiling point because we have an election in around about a month's time,
and
that's going to be really, really telling whether or not this dip in the, or this plunge in the currency makes any difference in that result. So that's another really interesting one. But certainly, you know, we are seeing very significant moves in foreign exchange, and some of these moves have been brewing for some time. I mean, I would say go back to February, and we do see a lot of these movements, a lot of these this dollar move really begin to take place back then.
Let's talk about Turkey and the Turkish lira. Record weakness once again earlier in the session. A bit of strength came through as the central bank started talking about taking the necessary steps. Jane, what are the necessary steps for the Turkish central bank to take now?
Well, if you'd asked that question a week ago, I might give you a different answer because, of course, earlier in the week, we did have President Erdogan in London. We had that interview with Bloomberg TV, and he seemed to indicate that the central bank is no longer an independent central bank. Now, really, for many people in the foreign exchange market, we would assume that if the currency goes into free fall, a central bank can come in and hike interest rates for potentially a temporary period of time and then would start to draw back on that.
Yeah.
If that central bank is not independent, can they really do that? Erdogan was saying that he wants rates to be lower, and he thinks that
right.
That needs to be done for the benefit of the Turkish economy. And that's really difficult for investors to reconcile.
It's a really important question, folks, and we must point out that since Ms. Foley trumpets the Guy Johnson interview, Guy Johnson just emailed me and said, you can have Jane back on again. But within that, Jane, is the old crux, which you won't see in a CFA exam, which is the idea that the markets test a central bank, whether it's the Hunts in silver a million years ago, blah, 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 or Soros and Sterling a zillion years ago. Jane, is that what happens? Markets test a institution in trouble?
Well, they can do, but there's degrees of being in trouble, and Turkey is always vulnerable because it does have a very large current account deficit, and that means it's more susceptible to the whims of non-domestic investors, and that is perhaps why you would expect a central bank like Turkey or the government of Turkey to actually want to replicate the international investing community a little bit more than we saw at the start of this week. So that is a currency that can be volatile. If you had a current account surplus currency, it's not so vulnerable to the whims of investors taking their money home. And unfortunately with Turkey, yes, it can be tested quite ferociously because of that current account deficit.
Jane Foley, it's great to catch up with you. Thank you for giving us your time at such short notice this morning as the foreign exchange starts to generate a few really interesting stories.
One of the joys we have is to dive into economic research and investment research from firms that are hyper-focused. That would include Haitong out of London. Haitong really digs into Asia, tries to, the phrase I use, go beneath the headline data and really find out what is going on. Miranda Carr joins us now, head of China thematic research at Haitong. Miranda, if you were to have a cup of coffee, not so much with the president, but just within anybody in Washington, what would you instruct them of how they are viewed or perceived from Beijing? How does Beijing perceive greater political Washington?
Well, I think the Washington under Trump has thrown a lot of the sort of Beijing's calculations into slight disarray because it's much more difficult to deal with someone who's where you're conflating a lot of the different issues, whether it's trade, intellectual property, dominance in different global markets, plus with sort of North Korea. So how you then go and tackle that is raising quite a lot of questions domestically. But I think, I mean, obviously sort of Leo He is over in Washington just now, and he's able to probably to offer sort of quite a bit on in terms of trade concessions.
Yeah.
But they're still not going to give much ground on terms of, you know, the made in China IP and trying to sort of stop China's
right.
technological process.
And what's so valuable about you being on the show is I think many of our listeners, if not most of our listeners, sort of kind of like understand when the president says he wants to make a deal, what that means. Or maybe we would understand what Mitch McConnell thinks when he says he wants to make a deal to get Republicans to vote with him, or Democrats to vote with him. I get that. When the Chinese say they want to make a deal, what do they mean?
Well, the thing is, a lot of the sort of trade war is not at all in China's interest. This is not something that's good for them, and they want to, you know, continue to trade, but also to continue to develop their domestic side. So, if they can get something where if they can increase imports even on a temporary basis, and get that side sorted out, but still be allowed to develop their sort of own technologies and their own companies, then that's the most important. But in terms of it being I think getting a deal done is going to be obviously the main focus. But then longer term, it raises more issues about how you control that intellectual property, and then the ongoing. I mean, I think what's happened, the real problem this time in getting a deal done, is it's made China realize they cannot rely on the US and US technology in the long term. So you've actually just raised the stakes quite significantly in the sort of long term game.
Miranda, what does realistic success look like? We've seen the demands from the United States, and I have to say, most people would agree, most of those demands are very reasonable. The Chinese need to open up. They haven't been doing it quickly enough. What's realistic, though, in terms of what the Chinese can give the United States?
Well, I think the focus, China's probably going to very much focus on increasing imports, and so it will offer to sort of reduce the trade deficit through increasing trade imports quite significantly. It can also say opening up the financial markets, opening up the auto markets, luxury goods, etc., because that's something that's been on the cards for quite some time. So it may be seen as a concession during the current talks, but it's actually been something which is, there's no major hurdle to that happening. The big issue where there's going to be massive pushback, though, is the request to stop the Made in China 2025 program and to stop the technological progress in China, because that, particularly with the whole ZTE disruption potential, then China's not going to want to rely on US technology. It's going to want to build more of its own domestic technology, and that sort of long term is not going to really be negotiable.
So, Miranda, what do you suggest is the best way for the United States to tackle what is a blatant attempt to dominate certain industries and using protectionist methods to do so? That is basically what Made in China 2025 is. How should the United States tackle that?
It's very difficult to do so, because the U.S., if the U.S. companies obviously rely on the Chinese market for quite a high proportion of sales. So if they try to put up barriers to China and sort of say, well, you can't develop this industry, then I think one of the threats has been that then China could take action against companies like Apple, which could obviously have very high revenues in China, and that could come under threat if you did have a complete breakdown in negotiations. But in terms of I think the key thing is to try to, the US and Japan faced similar issues back in the 1990s, and there was constant tension, and there was 301 investigations, and there was constant negotiations. But now you have a situation where both sides are developing their technologies. They're competitive, but they're also complementary.
Well,
now that would be the long term goal, okay, I think, for China.
Miranda Carr, thank you so much for the high tone. Greatly appreciate perspective there, thematic perspective on China. I got good news, folks. Kevin Cirilli's with us, our chief Washington correspondent. The bad news is he's a slow reader, and he's only on page 128 of 1,800 pages of Donald Trump Jr. transcripts, and I guess 2,500 pages total. Kevin, let's cut to the broader view here. Does Mr. Mueller care about these documents? Is there anything in here that would be news to a special counsel? Or is this old news in a media frenzy versus what the special counsel knows already.
Good morning, Tom. I'm embarrassed to say that I'm even slower than that. I'm only on about page 26 of these documents of a 2,500-page document dump. But so far from what I've gathered, as well as what other of my colleagues have gathered across the Beltway media, is that there doesn't appear to be new information regarding that meeting that Donald Trump Jr. had met with Paul Manafort, the president's previous campaign manager, or campaign chairman, with regards to a Russian lawyer. You'll remember that they had said they had walked out. They thought it was nothing. They were promised dirt on, quote-unquote, dirt, political dirt on former Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. I did get in touch with Donald Trump Jr. through a spokesperson, and he released a statement that he says, quote, he appreciates the opportunity to have assisted the Judiciary Committee. And he also actually thanked Chairman Grassley and Ranking Member Feinstein, a Republican and Democrat, respectively, for their quote-unquote professionalism.
Yeah, we read it on air, Kevin. It sounded like, you know, one of his good attorneys wrote it, which is great and all that. Help our global audience and our audience coast to coast that's not addicted to this like you are to the Philadelphia Eagles. What's the so what of this moment this morning?
Well, I think the so what is that it continues congressional investigations, which are separate from Bob Mueller's investigation, which quite frankly, I mean, both investigations matter. But if you're in the global audience, Bob Mueller's investigation is the one that matters the most because it's the one that could lead to a host of other potential problems, such as impeachment proceedings or whatnot. Not that I'm suggesting that there's any appetite for that right now. But that investigation from Bob Mueller is much more independent than the political investigations up on Capitol Hill. And the political investigations up on Capitol Hill really are only at this point used to kind of frame the goalpost of what's out of bounds and inbounds. And Bob Mueller's investigation is really the one that is the most notable. Does that make sense?
No, it does not make sense.
Sorry.
Get back to reading. Pim?
Well, Kevin, I want to know why, what was the impetus for Senator Grassley to release the documents?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things. I think that folks want to know what's going on, what was said. And I think from the administration standpoint, Pim, if they get the documents out there all at once, they're not being beholden to selective leakage. We should note that Senate Democrats did leak some excerpts ahead of the entire dump at 9 a.m. And then I think the Democrats, you know, they don't mind keeping this in the headlines as well. That said,
so this is political as much as anything
else. It's hard to see how these congressional investigations are not political at this point.
So does that make it more difficult for investigator Mueller to actually continue his investigation if this is really leak versus leak?
No, in the sense that I think that it also allow, if you talk to folks who are very much carefully following this in the political world, it allows for Bob Mueller's investigation team to kind of get things out in the public forum that otherwise might not be. And also to again, set the parameters of really what's an investigation here. I mean, when you have congressional committees, Bob Mueller's investigation, as well as intelligence saying that Russia tried to influence the election and divide Americans along every which way, I mean, that's now a fact.
Well, I know you're going to be busy. You've got a lot of pages to read today.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much. Kevin Cirilli,
anytime.
Our chief White House correspondent, knows all about what's going on in Washington.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.